As for the Afghans, we and our partners have airlifted 100,000 of them. No country in history has done more to airlift out the residents of another country than we have done. We will continue to work to help more people leave the country who are at risk. We're far from done.
President Biden yesterday delivering a speech to close out the 20-year conflict in Afghanistan. So where did those 100,000 Afghans go? Well, some are here in California, which Governor Gavin Newsom called a state of refuge.
Proud of the fact that over the last decade, California has taken in more refugees than any other state in America. And I'm proud of the fact a disproportionate number of Afghani refugees are here in Northern California, not just here in the South Bay, but also up and around Sacramento, Sacramento County. We're already working in terms of a lot of those refugees coming in and working with CBOs and nonprofit organizations to make sure that they feel welcome and celebrated as members of our community.
So how's it going here in Southern California? We're going to talk with two guests now. Sadiq Rashdin is an Afghan refugee who settled in Chatsworth with his family last month. Welcome to the program, Sadiq.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great to have you. And Lillian Alba is Vice President of Immigrant and Refugee Services for the International Institute of Los Angeles. Welcome, Lillian.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Great to have you too. So, Sadiq, let's begin with you. You are a father of three, and you and your family left Kabul, Saturday, August 14th, and that's the day, I believe, before the Taliban took the city. So what was it like in those final days in your home country and in Kabul?
Yeah, thank you. The day was, you know, very before the I depart Kabul, the situation was in Kabul is not normal like before, and we were, you know, took a backpack and all these that, you know, in an emergency we could depart Afghanistan. So we saw in some local news the Taliban arrived to the gates of Kabul, you know, and Kabul was surrendered by Taliban, and every day two to three provinces collapsed. So we decided to leave the country as soon as possible. I had the visa, the immigrant visa, and I planned to depart Kabul on Saturday, day before. So the morning I was, you know, very scary because the situation was not normal. And because I heard that the flights might be canceled, because on Saturday, the U.S. Mission sends troops to the Kabul airport, and the situation was not normal. And I, you know, thought with myself that the flight that I took, you know, that might be canceled. But fortunately, I took that flight to the Istanbul and then to the Los Angeles.
Yes, fortunately, because we saw what unfolded in the weeks after, and many Afghans are left behind. So you ended up in Chatsworth. How did you end up there?
I found it very friendly here. Yeah, the environment and the weather, especially, and because I have a friend here, and I wanted to resettle here to the Chatsworth.
But how did you decide to come here, or was that decision made for you?
Yeah, because the situation in Afghanistan made us, you know, to leave the country. And I heard more about the California, and because I don't have any friend in other states. So I prefer to come here, and because I'm new, and usually the newcomers need help and assistance. And so I just decided to come and live, you know, near to my friend's house.
I see. Okay. So Lillian, is that what happens, that in general refugees can decide where they want to be resettled, and they usually go where other Afghans are?
Yeah, so
usually,
there are
Oh, let's have Lillian answer if you don't mind. Thank you.
Yeah, so there are different factors that go into play when resettling a family. One of them is if they have what we know as U.S. ties, and this would be someone that they know locally, whether it's a friend or family member. That's for California, that is the requirement. We will not see refugees or families coming unless they have some type of connection with an immediate family member or a friend. Because of the cost of living and the shortage of housing, that is one of the requirements that the State Department has established. This is to ensure that families are well received and they have a place to stay in a short or long-term basis.
And who pays for their resettlement? Does the U.S. government pay for it?
The U.S. government does pay for the resettlement program. They do provide an initial resettlement grant of about $1,025 per refugee. And that's a one-time grant to assist families with putting the deposit, security deposit for an apartment, first month's rent, and then it is up to the resettlement agencies to establish connections with the community to gather donations, whether they're in kind or financial, to help with securing basic necessities, furnishings for the new homes.
So just $1,000 roughly per refugee, that's it? Federal government?
That is correct.
So that doesn't go far in Los Angeles, I imagine,
when
it comes to paying rent.
Absolutely. It literally goes to the first month's rent and security deposit. And so we do depend, we work really closely with the community and with other organizations to welcome families and ensure that they have resources. Refugees are eligible for public assistance programs and employment services. So we work as a community to ensure that families are immediately connected with employment programs so they can start working as quickly as possible.
Sadiq, what has been your experience when it comes to the money part of it? Is it, how are you doing? Do you have what you need?
Yeah, as I mentioned that usually there is two processes when you depart Afghanistan to the U.S. That is going through the IUM. And I just financially, you know, support myself and purchase my tickets by my own, and I came here. So as soon as I got, I applied for this social benefits and the assistance. So I'm very happy with that, and I got the social benefits and the resettlement package of the benefits. Yeah.
So I guess you're settling in still, but so far, how does it feel to be in this country now and watching what's happening to your country from afar?
Yeah, so when I arrived here, so I get some welcome letters, gifts, wishes from the American friends and families. So I feel I'm in my home. But when I saw in social media, the country's situation is very bad. There is, you know, my family's there and I miss them. And, you know, that's, but, you know, I feel very bad for them and for the country.
Yeah. Lillian, if people want to help Sadiq or others who are resettling here in Southern California, how do they do that?
We're encouraging our community residents to reach out to their local resettlement agencies to provide that support, whether it's, you know, from an airport reception, welcoming them, or offering basic donations for furniture, clothing, food. Many of the organizations, we are raising funds to help assist with housing costs. Because even though families will receive some assistance from public benefits, it is not going to be enough to help them cover the full cost of rent. Also, if the community knows of any landlords who have units available, they could reach out to a resettlement agency. At International Institute, we have a campaign. It's called Act Now for Afghan Allies, where we're hoping to connect with landlords and raise funds to help cover some of these initial housing costs.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much. And Sadiq, best of luck as you begin your new life here in the United States.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sadiq Rashtin, an Afghan refugee from Kabul. He arrived here with his family last month. And Lillian Alba, Vice President of Immigrant and Refugee Services, for the International Institute of Los Angeles. Coming up, will a key part of the Democratic base show up to vote no on the recall? So far, Latinos don't seem too enthused. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Polls show Governor Gavin Newsom has a slight lead in his race to hang on to his job. An average from the website 538 shows just more than half of the voters, 51%, are against the recall. But as is the case in all elections, turnout is key. And some Democrats are worried one important part of their base, Latinos, won't turn out in big enough numbers to help keep Newsom in power. We have two guests now to talk about that. Paul Mitchell is vice president of political data, a bipartisan voter data firm. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Amanda Renteria was national political director for Hillary Clinton and ran for governor against Newsom back in 2018. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. Paul, vote by mail this time, like last year's election, the presidential election, is so far skewing Democratic. That's no surprise. Are Latino voters who traditionally vote Democratic, are they also voting early?
When we go back to prior elections, 2018, 16, for decades before, it used to be Republicans that turned out early. Now it's Democrats, and largely because I think of this signaling where Democratic voters want to show that they're getting out voting early, and Republicans are wanting to show that they vote at the polls. It was a kind of a tectonic shift in voting patterns that happened in 2020 because of a lot of the rhetoric that was going on both sides. But what's interesting is as Democratic turnout has really spiked in this early vote by mail period, it's not bringing along a lot of those minority voters or younger voters. And when we talk about Latinos in California as registered voters, we really are talking about a younger segment of the electorate. So it's somewhat synonymous when you say low voter turnout for young people and low voter turnout for Latinos. To put it in a frame, right now, 40% of seniors have voted and only 10% of young people. 25% of white voters in California have returned a ballot, only 13% of Latinos. And so that underperformance is something I think that the Newsom campaign needs to worry about. So those analysts that are looking at that and concerned probably are right.
So Amanda, any theories as to why that is? Why the lack of interest among younger Latino voters in this recall election?
Yeah, so there's been a consistent, or you'll hear from the Democratic Party, what you'll hear from folks who have been on elections, is we've got to make sure that Latinos are really engaged early on in the process, that understand the new ways, mail-in ballots, et cetera, but also that candidates are speaking with Latinos where they are in their communities, online in different places, and that kind of work, particularly in a midterm election, you need to have done that during a general election in order to make sure now that you can communicate with those communities. And so this isn't too unusual as we're looking at young voters not showing up early. Now, what I will say is that there's been a lot of efforts by community-based organizations who have been trying to educate young voters, Latino voters in Spanish and in English, and that needs to continue. But there's no doubt in a special election, which is, you know, what this is, it is difficult for folks who haven't generation after generation been to the polls, been voting. And so you're seeing some of that work now. So there is concern, but there's also a lot of groups out there who are trying to make sure to close this gap in the final days of the election.
Yeah, it's not even a regular off-year election, and it's not even taking place in November. So there are all sorts of forces against it being people even knowing about it, right? I mean, is that the first hurdle, that people might not even know there is a recall election taking place?
There's just a heck of a lot going on in people's lives. And so to cut through not only the noise of messaging, but also the daily life of don't forget to get your mail-in ballot and send it in, or don't forget on election day, this is what you do. And having that message to young voters who may have not voted before or only vote in election, that's an entirely new education process and takes a heck of a lot of really groundwork to get people to the polls.
Right. And there's, what, 2 weeks left. So now Bernie Sanders is campaigning in an ad, at least, for Gavin Newsom. And young Latino voters really liked him when he was running. They call him Tio Bernie. Could that help?
It absolutely could. I mean, one of the things that in the Latino community, right, is to engage folks of being connected and being involved. The Tio Bernie effort was exactly right on in terms of community engagement, right? This is about, it speaks to, this is about your family, this is about your community, and really that informality of trusting Tio Bernie, right? It wasn't Uncle Bernie, it was always Tio Bernie, which in Latino communities, you know that is something, it means something, I gotta go do this for the family.
Okay, so Paul, given that, and given also the fact that during the last election, there were a bunch of Latino voters who went for Trump and other Republicans, especially in South Texas, for example. Could that also play out here in California in this election, like older Latino voters going for saying no to Gavin Newsom and going for a Republican in the second question?
Yeah, well, I think that there has been some polling that suggests that Latinos are not as lockstep with the Democratic side of this, if you think of it that way. And it might be because some of these communities were the most affected by COVID. Some of these communities have been most affected by the economic displacement and other issues that have been happening over the last year and a half. And I think that a lot of those communities really don't feel like they're connected with the solutions that are coming out of Sacramento. And so it makes some sense that there's a little bit more softness among those populations. But the campaign on the no side is doing a really great job, I think, of in some ways kind of nationalizing this campaign, bringing in Bernie Sanders, pulling back to those kind of national themes that turned out those voters and really polarized in California, polarized voters on the Democratic side. Although in states like Texas and Florida, we might have seen a little bit of softness on some other parts of the Latino community. And then we also can look, I'm sure today, I wouldn't be surprised to see an ad coming out in the next 24 hours from the Newsom campaign pointing out the fact that we basically lost Roe v. Wade at midnight last night. And making the point that kind of in a national way, we can't be on the wrong side of that issue in California. We can't afford to be on the wrong side of that issue when we no longer have federal protections in an area like choice.
Yeah. You're referring to the new Texas law that went into effect today. But I wonder, Amanda, if that would work with Latinos, because many Latinos, Democratic voters, are pretty conservative when it comes to abortion and pro-life issues.
Well, you're talking about, you know, I think what you're seeing in some of the data is the young versus older Latinos, there is a little bit of a split. There's also some splits, gender, on this issue as well. But I do have to say, you have to be careful, particularly Latinos in California and some of your more rural areas or in LA and LA County. You do have to be careful about nationalizing, right? All politics is local. And one of the things that I think is often missed in when people talk about the Latino community is everyone refers back to Prop 187. And some people interpret that as a moment for Latino empowerment when people looked at 187 as being against, you know, the Latino community. But partly the reason why people were so fired up for Prop 187 is because it spoke to this idea about making sure that our kids were not cut off of opportunity in schools and education. And so one of the messages that I think the Democratic Party or anyone running in a Latino state like California is to remember that it's not just about being against something, but making sure that you have a message for people on the ground about the future of their kids, of their families. And that's a really important piece that seems to be missing. And whenever you nationalize an election, you get away from that connection on the ground.
Paul, I'm wondering about Latinos and the Republican candidates. Are there any there who particularly are attractive to Latino voters?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything really compelling in any of the polling that suggests that there is kind of a Latino preferred candidate among the replacement options. There might be some regional aspects. Kevin Faulkner, having been a mayor in San Diego, might have a little bit more name recognition, but really it doesn't appear that there's a real strong resonance that any of those campaigns are making within the Latino community. And it's a challenge for them They want to have the recall be successful, but they're in this multi-front war with all the other replacement candidates to make sure that they're also the top vote getter. It's not as easy a time for them in those campaigns as it might be for the people who can just say, vote no, and, you know, leave the other option blank. That's a pretty easy message to send.
Well, given that it is an easy message, vote no, are you surprised that the polls are so close?
So I think that this race was closest when voters on the Democratic side weren't taking it seriously. The awareness that it was actually a real election is probably the thing that the Newsom campaign needed in order to kind of change the landscape. And I think if we were to look at the most recent polls, you're going to see, and the private polling, you're going to see that this race is probably widened to a 6 to 8% advantage for the no side.
For the governor's side. Paul Mitchell, yeah. Vice President of Political Data. Amanda Renteria, National Political Director for Hillary Clinton, now CEO of Code for America. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District could be headed for a long and expensive divorce. Malibu has long complained that their students aren't getting an equal education and that resources, classes, and programs aren't fairly distributed. But the split could be a financial blow to Santa Monica, where the median household income is a lot lower than in Malibu. Joining us to talk about this rift is Maria Laganga. She's staff writer for the LA Times, and she wrote about this today. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
I am fine, thank you. All right, so what are the primary reasons Malibu wants to leave?
Malibu's point of view is that it has only 15% of the students in the district, but its property taxes comprise 35% of the revenues that go to fund the entire school district. So they feel like they are ponying up a ton of money and not getting much back for it. They feel that their students don't get, at their high school, Malibu High School, there are only two, for example, foreign languages taught versus five taught. In Santa Monica, they feel like their students don't get programs like immersion language programs, like as many AP classes. So they feel like they don't get their bang for their buck and they want local control.
But why can't they get that without splitting? Why can't they have more foreign language or more AP classes?
They are a very small high school, for example. They have, I don't know, 500 or something students compared to 2,800 at Santa Monica High School. Mm-hmm. And the more students you have, the more people there are to take classes. I mean, if you only have three people who want to take chemistry, it's really hard to get a chemistry class. It's really hard to have a reason to have a chemistry teacher for three students.
Would they fare better on their own? I mean, they wouldn't have more students necessarily.
No, but they could control their money, and what they would be getting more money if it were divvied up the way they want it to. Which is, I mean, and that's another question. It's a big question about whether the way they want it divvied up is even legal, considering Prop 13 and various court cases, because they want to be able to take all of the property taxes that they pay in Malibu and use it for their own schools. It would be a lot more money for a lot fewer students. So they could say, okay, we only have four kids. We're going to offer Mandarin.
For those four kids. That's nice. Well, what about Santa Monica? What do they say? Do they not want this divorce?
Well, they do want a divorce because things have been so acrimonious for so many years. But what they say is they say that the plan that Malibu has hatched is, quote unquote, unconscionable, is what the superintendent of schools calls it. He basically says that it would strip so much funding from the bigger, more diverse district, and that it would leave them in the financial lurch. That Malibu has a 10-year plan. And what it would happen is they would get all of their, if things go in their favor, and that is a big question mark, they would get all of their property taxes for 10 years. And the chasm between Malibu and Santa Monica in terms of how much money they would each have would grow each year. For the 10 years, Malibu would give Santa Monica some money. But at the 11th year, there would be what the Santa Monica people call, they would be called falling off a cliff. And so they say that, you know, they'd have to increase class sizes at the Title I schools for kids who you know, need more help. They'd have to strip music classes and librarians and nurses and administrators. This is what they say. Malibu says that's not the case, but this is very much a he said, she said argument right now.
Right. And so this will be decided at a hearing, or at least it'll go forward or not at a hearing in, what, a couple of weeks from now?
Yeah, there's a September 18 hearing. Now, the way this happens, LA County has a school organization committee. It's an independent body. Malibu, the city, petitioned for this secession, and they put out their own financial plan. Now, there was a first part of a hearing in April, 3 hours on a Saturday, 300 people showed up via Zoom. But after 3 hours, it adjourned, and now the second half of that hearing is taken up on September 18th. Hopefully by that time, the County Office of Education will have its own feasibility study of Malibu's plan completed, and they'll have the second half of the hearing. And at that time, or soon thereafter, that body, the organization committee, will give the petition a thumbs up or a thumbs down. If they say Malibu can proceed with its efforts to leave the district, there will be yet another series of hearings, some in Malibu, some in Santa Monica. It would eventually go to the State Department of Education for a decision. It's a long, protracted process. If they say no, then the petition's dead. They can probably, you know, appeal to the courts, but they can't appeal to the county committee. But someone else could file yet another petition for Malibu.
Oh my gosh! And so now I see why it has taken so long, and they've been fighting over this for so many years and decades. Maria, thank you for the update.
My pleasure.
Maria Laganga, staff writer for the LA Times. Coming up, it is not your imagination. There are more mosquitoes here in Los Angeles, and they're more aggressive.
And these two species are notorious for sort of living in our backyards, biting us during the day, hiding in our households.
Yikes. What you can do to protect yourself next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, how many times have you had the mosquito conversation lately? As in, why are there so many mosquitoes in LA? There never used to be. Well, now we're going to have that conversation with a mosquito expert. Omar Akbari is a professor of cell and developmental biology at UC San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here today.
Well, it's great to have you. Okay, I'm going to ask you why, really, there didn't used to be so many mosquitoes, right? It's not just my imagination.
Yeah, I mean, so there's about 50 different species of mosquitoes in LA County. And, you know, I used to live in LA County, mm-hmm. and I don't remember mosquitoes when I was there either. But I guess now they're starting to become more abundant. And I think that has to do with climate change, but also the introduction of some more invasive species of mosquitoes that are a bit more of a nuisance. There are two species that have, since 2013, sort of become present in California, throughout California. And these are Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. And these two species are notorious for sort of living in our backyards, biting us during the day, hiding in our households. So I think the introduction of these two species has caused a lot of the more apparent problems that we're seeing with mosquitoes, because they're just a little bit more aggressive.
Right. And so they are biting during the day. That's also not in our imaginations. And usually you associate mosquitoes as coming out at dusk, but sometimes I see them in the middle of the day. or feel them.
Yeah. You know, I, and me too. You know, I live down right now. I live in San Diego, and I was working on my yard a couple of days ago, and they were biting my ankles, and I captured a few of them and brought them into my office because I have a little microscope, and I checked which species they are, and they were, and sure enough, they were Aedes aegypti. And, you know, there was mosquitoes here before, but they just were not as aggressive as these species are.
It seems to be in LA, we have these microclimates and the mosquito population is worse, at least anecdotally, on the east side than it is on the west side where it's cooler. Why is that?
Yeah. So, you know, these species do prefer certain climates. So on the east side, it's probably warmer than on the west side because you're closer to the water. So they prefer, you know, a little bit warmer, drier environment. And so that's probably why you find more of them there than you would by the coast.
You mentioned climate change. So you would think that it's pretty hot and dry now, or a lot hotter. Why would they like to be in a drier environment?
Yeah, I mean, so different species of mosquitoes prefer different types of environments. And I think it might have to do with just where they're native to, right? And these two species are native to Africa, right? That's where they originated. So it could be that where they're originally from is a lot drier. And so they just seek out those environments.
Okay, so how did they get here?
It's kind of unclear exactly how they got here. But what I can tell you is that these species, they lay their eggs in, you know, standing water. And when they lay their eggs, you know, their eggs have this ability to completely dry out and desiccate. And those eggs can survive like that for up to a year, completely dried out. And then when it rains or they get dipped in water, they just hatch out as mosquito larvae and then out come the mosquitoes. So it's possible that, you know, there is like eggs on, you know, things that get shipped overseas. And then, you know, when they get wet, they just kind of hatch out. But they're definitely here, and I think we're going to have to learn to live with them.
And this is the Aedes aegypti you're referring to.
It's actually two species, Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. These are also called the yellow fever mosquito and the Asian tiger mosquito. And they're easy to identify because when you look at them, they kind of look like Darth Vader. They have these black and white stripes on their legs. So just look for the Darth Vader look on a mosquito. And if you see it, it's one of those two species.
Well, should we be afraid that we're going to get yellow fever or any other horrible disease from these mosquitoes?
I think we should be afraid of that because, you know, these mosquitoes were not here prior to 2013. And now that they're here and they've established themselves, they do have the ability to transmit a number of different viruses. They transmit Zika virus, they transmit yellow fever, they transmit chikungunya virus, they transmit dengue virus. You know, and while we're not seeing local transmission in LA County or in California yet, it's just a matter of time. You know, if somebody goes and travels to a place where there is an abundance of dengue virus, for example, like Brazil, and then, you know, gets bit by mosquito there and then comes back here and then a mosquito bites them again. And that's how you get the transmission happening. Hmm. And so once it starts, it's hard to stop.
Well, you're working on one way, and that is to de-sex them. Correct? To make them infertile?
Exactly. So, you know, our lab at UCSD is working on sort of new innovative genetic control technologies. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to engineer the mosquito in such a way that the mosquito controls itself, right? There's nothing better than just releasing the species on itself and having that species go and sort of suppress and eliminate and potentially eradicate the species. And the beauty is that it's a very species-specific technology. And when you release male mosquitoes don't bite or transmit pathogens, but they have the ability to find female mosquitoes really well. And so they seek them out, they find them, and they can suppress populations that way. So it's a really reliable way to control populations that is safe and doesn't rely on harmful chemicals being released into our environment.
Well, I guess there's always the fear when humans are playing with nature that there could be unintended consequences. Are there any consequences that you're considering that could actually be harmful if we mess with them this way?
I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, I think one answer to that question is the species that we're trying to eliminate and eradicate from, you know, let's say California, for example, was not here, you know, prior to 2013. Right. So it doesn't really play an essential role in the ecosystem. So if we remove it, we don't anticipate any negative unintended consequences. Another point to that is, you know, we're genetically engineering the mosquito to control itself. We're not going to be, you know, spraying something that is going to be killing honeybees and things, beneficial insects, you know, that also has adverse effects on our agriculture, right? So we're trying to do things in the safest way possible to eliminate a threat that is not native to this place, right? So I think I'm not so worried about that.
When do you think this is going to happen?
Yeah, so we're hoping to, you know, there is a pipeline to actually taking a technology from the lab to the environment. And there's just all these like phase testing that has to get done. So we're hoping like, you know, within the next 5 years, we'll have something that we can start, you know, releasing into the environment. And that's kind of our goal, but, you know, it's going to take some time to get there.
Okay, so until then, what do we do to protect ourselves?
Well, until then, you're kind of stuck with what we have currently, and that is going to be, you know, obviously using DEET, which is a repellent that you can put on your skin that can sort of prevent the mosquitoes from biting you. There is a vector control unit in most counties throughout California that, you know, if you find mosquitoes in your yard, you can call them and you can tell them, hey, I found mosquitoes, and they can come out and sort of treat those areas with insecticides.
Okay. And maybe stay indoors.
Well,
I don't know,
stay indoors.
They seem to find you when you're indoors too. So I don't know. There seems to be no escape.
Well, you know, when you leave your screen open, they'll fly in and they'll hide inside your house and they'll get you at night. You know, they're like I said, these species, they like to dwell in your households. So you should check your bathrooms before you go to bed and make sure they're not hiding on the ceiling. And if they are, kill them before you go to sleep, or they're going to get you they'll get you at night when you're sleeping too.
Gosh, they're like vampires.
They're a nuisance for sure.
For sure. Omar Akbari, he's a professor of cell and developmental biology at UC San Diego. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Al Capone's granddaughter is here. She's auctioning off some of his possessions. Although he's one of America's most notorious gangsters, she really saw a softer side. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Al Capone was one of the most notorious mobsters from the last century, known for his Chicago bootlegging empire and violent battles with rival gangs. He topped the FBI's most wanted list and served 4.5 years at Alcatraz in the 1930s. His real name was Alphonse Gabriel Capone. Some called him Scarface for a long, intimidating scar on his cheek. But to his family, he was known as Papa, and they've described him as a gentle family man. Joining us now is his granddaughter, Diane Capone. She recently announced an upcoming auction of her grandfather's belongings in Sacramento next month. That auction will include family photos, a diamond pocket watch, and his favorite pistol. Diane, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. Well, can you reach back into your memories of your grandfather? He died a long time ago, 1947. You were really young, but do you remember anything from him, anything about him?
Actually, I do. Not an awful lot, but I do have some pretty vivid memories. I was a very little girl, and I remember very clearly my grandfather playing with us in the garden. His hands were so big and my hands were so little, I couldn't hold his hand, but I'd hold on to his finger, and he'd walk me around as he did with my sisters. But he loved to play with us. He was very affectionate. He loved to hold us in his lap and read to us. One of the memories that I think is the most profound for me is shortly after my third birthday, Papa and I had celebrated our birthdays together. My birthday is the 14th of January. His is the 17th. And so we'd had a joint birthday celebration at the house on Palm Island. and blown out candles together. And just a few days later, he became very ill. I remember distinctly being taken up the stairs to his bedroom by my mother on the day that he died. And my father lifted me up onto the bed so that I could kiss Papa. And he looked at me and he said, "I love you, baby girl." And those were the last words that he said to me. Mm. And that memory is indelibly imprinted on my in my mind and will be, I think, until the last breath I take.
And he was only 48 years old when he died, right? And he died of heart failure,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. He'd been suffering from pneumonia at the time, which had come on fairly suddenly. But yes, it was a heart failure.
Well, that is quite a powerful memory. And so I guess as you became an adult, you learned the other side of Al Capone, who he was in his professional life, if you will. How did that square with what you remembered of him?
Well, you know, Madeline, actually, it doesn't. There's no way I can kind of put the two together. The man that we knew personally was a man who was so loving and so devoted and generous and good-natured. I never caught a glimpse of his public persona. And so it was a number of years later when I was quite grown. I mean, I knew even as a child that there was something about the Capone name because we all lived with that. And there were times when people made comments, but I didn't know anything about the breadth of his public life until I was quite a bit older. And so it's been a challenge throughout our lives to try to reconcile, first of all, what was the truth of his public life, although there was no doubt that he was involved in a criminal enterprise, but how we could somehow get those two things to gel because our experience with him was so completely different.
What did his wife, your grandmother, say about all of that when you could ask her about it when you were older? What did she say about her husband?
Well, I was very, very blessed. My grandmother lived for many, many years after my grandfather died. She lived until 1986. And for many years after we moved to California, she would come out every year and she would visit and she always stayed at my house. And so I had an opportunity to ask her lots of questions. And I did, and in fact, a lot of it is recounted in the book I wrote a couple of years ago, which is called Al Capone and the Stories My Grandmother Told Me. Oh. My grandmother adored my grandfather. There was no question that there were challenges in their marriage, but she never stopped loving him. She never stopped believing in him, and she never took off her wedding rings.
And did she ever talk about his criminal enterprise with you?
No, she really didn't. Reality is that in the life that people who were involved in that kind of enterprise, their families were kept completely removed from what was happening. Naturally, she was a young woman who lived in Chicago with him during a period when some of this was going on, and she could read newspapers, so she had an idea of what was being said, at least in the newspapers. But for many, many years while they were in Chicago, Papa didn't even live at the house with the family. He lived in a hotel in a different part of town. He tried to distance himself as much as possible for their protection. And so I don't think she ever knew in any detail what he was involved in. Of course, she knew a great deal more later on. And we just didn't talk about that as nearly as much as we talked about who he was as a young man, how they fell in love, what their story was.
And so you are auctioning off some of his belongings, including, as I mentioned, a pistol, his favorite pistol.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you know if that pistol was used for anything untoward.
I don't. I know that the reason why he referred to it as his favorite and it was called Sweetheart was because it saved his life on a number of occasions. Because of my grandfather's position and the fact that there were numerous rival gangs, attempts were made regularly on his life. And my understanding is that particular gun saved his life on some of those occasions. And that's why he referred to it as Sweetheart.
Okay. And one of the other items I understand you're going to auction is a letter that he wrote when he was in Alcatraz, because he was never convicted of ordering the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929,
that's right.
But he was convicted of tax evasion, and he
that's
was sent
correct.
To Alcatraz. And he wrote this letter to your dad, his only child, and what does it say?
Well, the letter is almost poetic, Madeline. It's very moving. It's very emotional. And even now, years after I've read it over and over again, it still is so touching because it's so reflects the affection that my grandfather had for my dad. He refers to him as dearest son of my heart over and over again in the letter, and he refers to what they're going to do when he comes home and that he's never going to leave him again and how much he misses him and how much he loves him repeatedly throughout this letter. It's a love letter from a father to a teenage son. And when you read it, it's hard to believe that a man who had such devotion to his child and his wife could have been capable of doing a lot of the things that he was accused of.
Well, people can compartmentalize, I suppose.
That's absolutely true. And apparently he was one of the people who was capable of doing that.
And so that seems like a very, I don't know, just a very valuable family keepsake. Why would you want to auction that off?
Well, because we've lived with all of these items for many years now. My sisters and I have lived with these things, as I've said, for many years since my father died in 2004. And we have realized recently we are all getting older. We're all in our 70s. And so we decided that because we're at the age we are now, if we were going to deal with these things and make sure that they were properly handled or passed on, along with the stories that go with some of these items, we had to take charge of it. We had to be responsible for doing that. We couldn't leave these things till later when people wouldn't know whose they were or what the stories were that went with them. But the other thing is the fires. Mm-hmm. For the last 2 years, my husband and I have spent weeks of the summer with our bags packed by the front door, knowing that if, God forbid, we were evacuated, we couldn't take Papa's things. Our grandparents' things would go up in smoke. And so we finally decided that the time had come for us to pass on these items.
Oh, well, that is certainly a sad commentary on our times, but I totally understand, and I wish you the best of luck in your auction.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the call, and I hope all goes well for you.
You too. That's Diane Capone. She's the granddaughter of the late mobster Al Capone and author of the book Al Capone, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. All right, that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you tomorrow.